It is Monday, February 22nd, Universal Time, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Coming up, could the United States and Russia finally bring a ceasefire to Syria's long-running civil war? We'll find out from our State Department correspondent. We'll hear from a Korea analyst who isn't surprised by new revelations that Washington and Pyongyang held talks about negotiating a peace treaty. And I'll speak with a friend of the late U.S. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia about how the justice was remembered at a funeral here in Washington. It's all ahead on International Edition. The United States and Russia have reached an agreement to persuade their allies in Syria's civil war to lay down their weapons starting this weekend. It's the latest of many efforts by the international community to bring relief to Syria's long-suffering people, many of whom are in urgent need of humanitarian aid. All previous attempts at prolonged ceasefires have failed. I spoke earlier to our State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins and asked her how the U.S.-Russian truce initiative came about.
Well, this flowed out of the initial plan that the International Syria Support Group reached in Munich earlier this month. And the group set up a ceasefire task force that is being led by the U.S. and Russia. And the group initially hoped to have a cessation of hostilities in place by this past Friday. They, of course, missed that deadline. The fighting has continued, and now there's word of this new plan. And under this plan, the ceasefire would begin on February 27th. It would not include terrorist entities such as the Islamic State and al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda affiliate. The U.S. and Russia said the plan calls for setting up what they called a communication hotline that would help promote and sustain the ceasefire. But a lot of the other details still need to be ironed out. State Department spokesman Mark Toner said that he fully expects more details to come out over the next few days on how this ceasefire will be monitored. The initial plan indicates that there will be a lot of reliance on groups such as NGOs and journalists in Syria to provide feedback on who's being hit and also on possible ceasefire violations.
Well, how confident are U.S. officials that those groups can do the job and inform them and the rest of the world about how this agreement is being kept?
There seems to be cautious optimism on the U.S. side at this point because there are still some provisions of the agreement that they need to work out. Now, Secretary of State Kerry and his Russian counterpart, Foreign Minister Lavrov, have been holding a series of talks on this. Kerry has also been meeting with other members of the International Syria Support Group. He spoke today with his British, French, and Turkish counterparts. And over the past weekend, of course, he was in Jordan and met with Nasser Judeh in Amman. So officials are taking a cautious approach on going forward as they continue to look at ways to fully implement this plan and also some of the monitoring mechanisms.
President Obama and Russian President Putin did address this agreement today. What did they say about it?
Yes, they did. They spoke by phone on the issue, and the White House released a statement. It said that Obama emphasized that the priority now is to ensure a positive response from the Syrian government and the opposition, and also to make sure that all of the parties involved implement the ceasefire. Also, White House spokesman Josh Earnest weighed in. He admitted that the ceasefire would be difficult to implement, and he said he expected there would be obstacles and setbacks. But he also called it a moment of opportunity and said he hopes that all of the parties could capitalize on it.
Well, thank you so much to VOA's Pam Dawkins for updating us from the State Department.
Thank you.
Well, up next, we have our social media correspondent, Giabi Lee, with me in the studio to bring us the buzz on Twitter. Hi, G.
Hi, Michael.
So we just heard from Pam about the U.S.-Russia deal on Syria. Who else is discussing it on social media?
As you can imagine, many U.S. government Twitter accounts are talking about it, from the U.S. Embassy in Syria to the White House. The White House National Security Council, or the NSC, shared a readout of President Obama's call with his Russian counterpart. The NSC is on Twitter at NSC44. Secretary of State John Kerry also sent out two tweets about the latest decision. He wrote he's gratified to see final agreements concluded for ending hostilities in Syria. And he added, if adhered to, cessation will lead to declining violence, expanded delivery of urgently needed humanitarian supplies to hashtag support Syrians.
And I think they really do need that support. Well, did Kerry get any interesting replies to his tweets?
He did. And actually, the most liked response to that tweet was asking him why he isn't running for the president.
Well, he said he isn't at the moment anyway.
No. But going back to the Syria topic, one of the comments asked if this ceasefire is going to be like the Iran deal. Michael, if we're looking into the public opinions on Russia, we have to check out the country's state-owned Russia Today, or RT for short.
That's right. Well, what is RT saying?
Well, it tweeted Russia and the U.S. are going to work together to determine non-terror groups in Syria, and that invited a flurry of colorful replies. One of them reads like this: good luck. As Russia should know from Ukraine, Jews will even work with neo-Nazis to hurt Russia. That was quite anti-Semitic. Another one reads like this: Antichrist in action. Put this one in Marvel Comics. Others still had a question on the relationship between Washington and Moscow. One user wrote, must be nice working together with a country that's still sanctioning you. And of course, people are also talking about Turkey's involvement. One comment reads like this: the question is, will Turkey and its minions comply? That's all for me today, Michael.
Thanks so much, G. You can follow G Abby Lee on Twitter. Her handle is at G Abby Lee. I'm also there. You can find me at Michael_Lippin. And you can also tweet our program. Its handle is at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Astronomers from Vanderbilt and Harvard universities have discovered a binary star system nearly 10,000 light years from Earth, where it takes 69 years for one of its stars to eclipse the other. But once it does, the eclipse lasts for 3.5 years. The researchers described their findings in a paper that's been accepted for publication in the Astronomical Journal. This star system, which has no official name, has set a new record for having both the longest duration stellar eclipse and the longest period between eclipses in a binary system. Until this discovery, the previous record holder was Epsilon Origae, an eclipsing binary system that is only 2,000 light years from Earth. That star system's yellow giant star is eclipsed by its normal-sized companion, that's slightly bigger than our sun, for 640 to 730 days every 27 years. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
I'm Michael Lippin with VOA's International Edition. U.S. stock markets and oil prices made strong gains on Monday, recovering some of the value they lost during the past year and a half. I asked our markets reporter in New York, Jill Malandrino, what's behind the positive market trend that's continuing from last week.
Well, it's nice to see after the dismal January 2016 that we traded through, February's actually positive on the month as it stands right now. Just looking at the action on Monday, crude oil is up 6% on the day and has surged from that $26-ish low that we've seen. That definitely has something to do with the bullish action that we've seen in the market. To a lesser extent, we're starting to see participation from the financial sector, which in my mind is even more key than oil providing a bid back into the market. There is a lot of uncertainty within the financials because of all of the currency moves that we've seen, a lot of the central bank policy shift that has occurred over the past 6 weeks. And of course, we're going to see some more jockeying coming into that when we go into the March FOMC meeting. So I like what we're seeing in oil. We did get the participation in banks. I think what's even more important is if we see sector rotation out of utilities, if we see sector rotation out of defensive names and back into consumer discretionary, back in technology. And really the key is going to be not a bounce in financials, but investing in fresh cash back into financials.
Can you tell us which energy companies are benefiting from the rebound in oil prices?
The energy companies that are benefiting are the ones that don't have horrible balance sheets, where they're over-levered in debt. The assets are essentially worthless, where the debt is worth less than the equity. And there's a few of the smaller producers, the outliers, that are not going to survive this regardless of what the price of oil is. You're going to get a rebound from your stronger names like a Chesapeake, a Conoco, an Exxon, a Phillips, and we've seen some dividend cuts. But if we continue to get this rally in oil and it's sustainable, those are the companies that are your legacy blue chip names, the ones that do pay dividends, the ones that do have the cash on the balance sheet to invest in assets as you start to see the outlier producers either fold or get bought up by other companies. You want stronger blue chip names. You don't want to look at speculative stocks with oil fundamentals still being relatively weak. And the key is looking at the debt and the assets that these companies hold.
Well, even though the fundamentals of oil are weak, as you say, oil prices have gone up about 20% in a week and a half. What's driving that trend?
Well, what's interesting, if you want to isolate it to Monday, is the way oil trades, they trade in what's called futures contracts. And today, Monday, the March contract is expiring and fresh oil trade for April will start on Tuesday. So I really want to see what Tuesday looks like. If, in fact, it really is fundamentals, if we're starting to see progress out of the OPEC and non-OPEC meetings where we're going to see production cuts, production stabilization, to really get supply and demand back in balance. So I wouldn't look at it as very near term with today's trading. I want to look out a little bit longer than that when we start getting fresh trade on Tuesday in the most current oil contract.
Okay, well, thank you so much to our markets reporter in New York, Jill Malandrino, for that report.
Okay, thanks very much.
The United States has disclosed that it held discussions with North Korea about a possible peace treaty between the two sides, but ultimately rejected negotiations because Pyongyang refused to abandon nuclear weapons. The two nations remain formally in a state of conflict from the Korean War of 1950 to 53, which only ended with a truce. The U.S.-North Korean talks were first reported on Sunday by the Wall Street Journal newspaper. My colleague Victor Beatty discussed the revelation with Korea analyst Sung-Yoon Lee of Tufts University. Lee said the U.S. desire for a peace deal with North Korea is part of a pattern.
But the fact that the Obama administration, despite having taken a strong stance against North Korea under the rubric of strategic patience, actually agreed to hold talks without preconditions of North Korea making a sincere effort at denuclearization, confirms, I would say, the past quarter century pattern of U.S. administrations in the twilight days being eager to lunge at any political deal with North Korea, probably mainly for the sake of carving out some kind of a North Korea legacy. So this shows you that the executive branch has not really handled the North Korea problem very well over the past 25 years. It shows that North Korea strikes a hard bargain and is very crafty, and we should stop patronizing them. And it also shows that North Korea, it suggests, I should say, that North Korea, in order to get what it wants, needs to go on resorting to provocations.
The narrative has been in the past that the North does want bilateral talks with the United States, lending itself some legitimacy if such talks get underway. So why would they scuttle them by doing these tests?
Because rather than just seeking some semblance of legitimacy in the eyes of the international community, what North Korea really wants is by getting a peace treaty, and some of your listeners might be thinking, what's wrong with a peace treaty? Sounds good, sounds peaceful, much better than a ceasefire agreement, is it not? A peace treaty between North Korea and the United States would call into question the very raison d'etre of some 28,000 U.S. soldiers, troops stationed in South Korea.
And we were listening to Sung-Yoon Lee of Tufts University speaking with International Edition's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. U.S. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, who died on February 13th at age 79, was remembered by thousands of mourners at a Roman Catholic funeral mass here in Washington on Saturday. The service was led by one of Scalia's sons, who is a priest. One of those who attended the funeral was Jack Roslowski, a friend of Scalia's and the president of the high school the justice attended in New York City. I spoke with Roslowski on the phone and I asked him what he thought of the service.
I think Father Paul did a terrific job. You know, it's not easy to bury your dad as the main celebrant, and I think he really paid great honor to his dad by his presence and his words. You know, what Father Paul made very clear was his father's deep faith, his love of the church, his love of the sacraments, his belief in the importance of faith in modern life, in the life of the country, and in his own work. And it was very moving for me. There was a humility to the service. There was a sacredness and a sanctity to the service that was just a blessing to be part of. And I think, you know, the justice can get has gotten a lot of attention for his judicial work, for his means of interpreting the Constitution. Equally important, maybe more important, is his life of faith, his belief in God, his belief that God cares for people and creation, and that care comes out through the life of the church. And it was just great to be part of that. You know, going back to his time at Xavier is a Jesuit Catholic institution, right, is an apostolic work of the church. And that was part of the justice's life from his earliest days. And it was part of his life, you know, really to his last day on earth.
Well, it does seem now that we have a vacancy in the court that needs to be filled, that if President Obama does nominate someone and have that nominee confirmed, that new Supreme Court justice may not necessarily share the same deep faith that Justice Scalia had. Was he ever concerned that any justice that would come onto the court after himself or after his colleagues would be of not quite as deep a faith as he had?
Well, I was never privy or party to any conversations with the justice about that topic specifically or about his successor. As I said, certainly his faith was important to him, and he had a deep belief that faith was important in the life of the country and in civil society, and that it connected in important ways to the common good. And I think he also had respect for people of other faiths and other backgrounds. The other thing I can say with certainty is his great belief in the Constitution, right? We all know that. And in the power of the court, you know, so I think I can extrapolate from there to say the justice would want someone to follow him who again shared those fundamental beliefs in the wonder, the power, the goodness of America rooted in the Constitution, a commitment to the common good, and an understanding of the role of faith in the life of America, whatever his or her own religious tradition.
Well, thank you so much to Jack Roslowski, president of Xavier High School in Manhattan, New York City, for sharing your thoughts with us about Justice Scalia today.
It's my pleasure, Michael. All the best to you.
Well, now to entertainment news. The U.S. movie industry's annual Academy Awards are coming up this Sunday, and one of the films nominated in the Best Documentary category is Winter on Fire. The film by Evgeny Afanevsky chronicles the mobilization of 1 million Ukrainians against a corrupt political regime and their bloody clashes with police in 2013 and 2014. VOA's Penelope Pulu has more.
1 million people gathered at Kiev's Maidan Square and other central locations in the city in November 2013, outraged by President Yanukovych's decision to abandon a far-reaching accord with the European Union in favor of stronger ties with Russia. As the protests intensified, men, women, even children called for him to step down. The peaceful rally turned violent when Yanukovych's special police forces, called the Berkut, descended on unarmed civilians. Evgeny Afanevsky kept on filming.
At that particular moment, None of us was thinking about danger. All of us were thinking how to document every second and kind of preserve this history.
Winter on Fire exposes the police hitting people and shooting indiscriminately. Despite the bitter cold and thousands of casualties, protesters endured. Afinevsky says he would not have been able to film this unraveling events without the help of social media and multimedia.
I started to talk to the filmmakers, professionals and non-professionals who've been there, because every person who had some vision or who had some piece of equipment, and I had usage of DSLRs, camcorders, cell phones, GoPros, tablets, every possible technology was helpful for us.
After 93 days of violence, the Yanukovych administration fell. A few days later, the Berkut was disbanded. The Ukrainian parliament canceled anti-protest operations, restored the 2004 constitution, and freed political detainees. Evgeny Afinevsky's documentary Winter on Fire presents yet another example of how civic unity and sacrifice can force political change. Penelope Poulou, VOA News, Washington. Slow Ukraine!
And that movie review brings us to the end of International Edition on the Voice of America. Our director today was Tracy Carter, and the engineer was Zaina Abdelrahman. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. If you'd like to reach us on Twitter, you can find the show at @VOA_IE. You can also find me there. I'm @Michael_Lippin. We'll see you next time, and have a great week.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Secretary of State John Kerry says the United States intends to engage in very serious conversations with China after civilian satellite imagery indicated that China deployed surface-to-air missiles on a contested island in the South China Sea. The island in question is Woody Island, part of the Paracel Island chain. The chain is claimed by China, Taiwan, and Vietnam. China has said it will not militarize in the South China Sea, but, Mr. Kerry noted, there is evidence every day that there has been an increase of militarization of one kind or another. It's a very serious concern, he said. China's latest apparent move on Woody Island follows other dubious activities by China in the South China Sea in recent months. In addition to the Paracel Island chain, China also claims sovereignty over the disputed Spratly Islands and, in an enormous dredging operation, has built several artificial islands in the area, some equipped with airstrips, which observers say could be used for military purposes. The United States takes no position on the sovereignty of disputed features in the South China Sea region, but has encouraged the countries involved to solve their disputes diplomatically and peacefully in accordance with international law. In January, the U.S. Navy sent a ship near Triton Island, part of the Paracel Island chain, in order, said the U.S. Department of Defense, to challenge excessive maritime claims that restrict the rights and freedoms of the United States and others. During a press conference at the conclusion of the recent U.S.-ASEAN summit in California, President Barack Obama underscored the U.S. and ASEAN's strong commitment to a regional order where international rules and norms and the rights of all nations, large and small, are upheld. Toward that end, President Obama emphasized the need for tangible steps in the South China Sea to lower tensions, including a halt to further reclamation, new construction, and militarization of disputed areas. He added that freedom of navigation must be upheld and lawful commerce should not be impeded. The United States, said President Obama, will continue to fly, sail, and operate wherever international law allows, and we will support the right of all countries to do the same.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.